Sandwich Tape Ministry, Queensland. It's now Monday evening, the 4th of April, 1988, and we're at the Clayfield Girls College for a special lecture evening with guest speaker Dr. John Court from Adelaide. Dr. Court's address on this cassette, being cassette number 2 of the evening, is dealing with the subject of pornography.
The media, about some of the effects of the media on attitudes and behaviour, and focused particularly on violence in the media and the use of sexual themes, particularly more explicit sexual themes in the media, to the extent that they are having some sort of powerful impact on what's happening in our society. It's a very complex subject, and I really will only not do justice to any of it, but hope to touch on a number of issues that I believe ought to be emphasised at the present time, because a tremendous amount of research has gone on over the last 20 or so years, and a lot of debate, and I hope that some of you may even have seen a television programme a week ago on the subject, chaired by Pat Brennan. Anybody see that? One? All right. I won't presume for the rest of you that you saw that, but it was actually a very interesting focusing in on the issues as they're being raised in discussion among a number of psychologists and criminologists, and a young man who was a law student saying how he'd been led into his crimes by watching particular movies and Starsky and Hutch he mentioned. The professional evidence is hardening in this area, and I'd like to explain where it's got to in my judgment at the present time, and hopefully to challenge you to not just let it pass you by as something you can't do anything about or is of no consequence, because I believe as Christians we ought to be aware of what's happening and ready to respond appropriately. In speaking, I'll be drawing in part on two book sources. I haven't got a mic on, have I? I'm sorry. Has it been going over there anyway? In speaking on this subject of violence and related effects on the media, I'll be drawing on two book sources which are very recent. One is a thing called the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography, final report published in 1986 in the United States of a major investigation into that area of material, followed by a book called Pornography, A Human Tragedy, edited by Tom Minnery, published by Christianity Today, with contributions by Chuck Colson, James Dobson, and C. Everett Koop, the US Surgeon General. And it would have had a chapter by me, but the chapter I wrote was apparently too historical, and there was so much current evidence they dropped my chapter, to my disappointment. But it's a good book anyway. More of that perhaps as we go along. A lot of people are asking hard questions about the effects of the media on people's attitudes and behaviour at the present time. No less a worthy document than the Advertiser from Adelaide on the 4th of April 1988, which I had time to read in the plane this morning. Advertiser opinion poll. Do you think there should be more or less control over the possession of adult-style video movies? They surveyed 542 people. 73% of those surveyed said there should be more controls. 60% believed video movies affect sexual behaviour either strongly or very strongly. 83% believe violence has a very strong or strong effect on behaviour. And that 83%, I would have to agree, are right. The other 17% haven't yet caught up with the evidence. Psychologists have been studying the subject for a number of years, and I've, in a research way, as well as in my clinical work, been seeing the issues quite starkly for a number of years. And so I'm interested in encouraging other people also to take a look at the evidence and the implications of the evidence. I'd like to be able to joke about it and make it an entertaining, humorous kind of presentation at a time like this, late in the evening, to keep you awake, but I can't do that. I find when I make jokes in this area of violence or sexuality, the jokes have to be either sick or somehow turn you off, because what's one person's humour is another person's dismay. And it's not at all easy to be funny in a clean, good sense about such a rotten subject.
why you'd want to come and hear me talk about such a rotten subject, I don't know, but maybe you'll decide after you've been that you wish you hadn't. But let's take the risk. I'll try and be straight on the subject rather than humorous. You'll still hear people saying that there's no evidence of really harmful effects from what we see on television, including violent television. And there was one person on that program I mentioned a week ago on the ABC who put that point, that he didn't think there were any harmful effects. When you hear remarks like that, you should give those people as much credibility as you give to people who say they don't think there's any link between smoking and lung cancer. They're either ill-informed or they have some vested interest for commercial or ideological reasons in refusing to acknowledge the evidence. There are, of course, all kinds of technical arguments about the nature of the links between violence and violent media, as there are between smoking and lung cancer, such that it's very difficult to say anything clear, straight, and unequivocal. But that doesn't in any way invalidate the fact that there is a link, and there is a very powerful and important link, and a link we can do something about. Certainly then, there are many technical questions that the scientists still have to ask, but accumulatively it's difficult to ignore the fact that the overwhelming picture we now have in relation to violence in the media is that serious harm does occur, not in all cases, but in many. Not just in sick people, but in many ordinary, well-adjusted people. One of my students, 15 years ago, wrote a research thesis in this area and summarised the research studies by saying this, and remember, this is 15 years ago, at that time, said, each of the flaws in the various research studies tends to be unique rather than shared by all investigators. The studies are quite consistent in the overall direction of their findings. The accumulated weight of evidence of surveys, correlational studies, and experiments conducted in the laboratory and out in the field indicate that there is a directional link between exposure to television violence and an observer's subsequent aggressive behaviour. Now, that student was careful not to say there is a causal link between what people see and what they do, because that has not been shown and probably can't be shown in any satisfactory way. But that doesn't matter too much. That's a technical problem about this business of causation. The fact is that all kinds of things converge to bring about the way we behave or the attitudes we adopt. We can talk about multiple factors, various reasons. We can never say A caused B when we come to the way people behave. So that even an apparently simple statement like eating causes people to get overweight, or perhaps I should correct that, too much eating causes people to become overweight. You can shoot holes through that kind of proposition when you think of the number of people who eat far too much and are not overweight, and the number of people who seem to eat next to nothing who are constantly having a weight problem. It isn't simply a matter of calories in, weight on. It's much more complicated than that. And so it is in the area of violent media or sexual media influences. Way back in 1973, in Britain, the Independent Broadcasting Authority reported in a working party that they were convinced that there is no alternative to a continuing assumption that the portrayal of violence may have harmful effects. They reported that to the Council of Europe in 1983, and at that time they reported over 700 pieces of international scientific research demonstrating positive linkages between televised violence and actual social violence. Most of the early work, which was relevant and interesting, was conducted in laboratory studies. And any of you who have studied this area and thought about it will know that the famous experiments are on what they call these Bobo dolls, these bouncing inflatable dolls that children watched being pounded about with bats. And then after they'd watched these on bits of television, they observed the children's behaviour later and found that children imitated this kind of behaviour, and it was concluded that they were responding to the apparent violence in these Bobo dolls in attacking them. I mean, they are designed for doing it, and I suppose it would be difficult not to imitate it. But from that fairly simple laboratory beginning, the studies have gone much wider and into the real world, and we find that we can now generalise far beyond the laboratory and say that the same effect is measurable again and again in the real world. In particular, we find two effects which are repeated over and over again, which somehow come together in real behaviour. The first most commonly documented effect is what's called the desensitisation effect. Simply put, that means that once we've seen, say, violence on the screen, we progressively find ourselves less and less reactive to it. So we then see more and more, to the point that eventually we can become quite callous to material which originally produced a strong emotional reaction. Most of us can recall times when in the past we've seen things which made us squeamish and may have been quite upsetting. But with repeated exposure to such events, it's common for us to become less and less squeamish and increasingly able to tolerate such material with little or no emotional reaction at all. Have you experienced that yourselves? If you hadn't, there's something wrong with you. We do. There was a time when I found looking at blood and gore and shootings on the television was unpleasant in black and white. And then came colour, and it became rather more horrible, and at first it was all rather yuck. And now we see it regularly and nightly on the news if we choose to watch, and children watch it, and they say, ho-hum, somebody else been shot dead. And you get that situation where a man announces he's going to commit suicide and the television cameras come and film him putting a gun in his mouth and shooting his own head off. And nobody complains. Nobody says that's not appropriate. Correction. Two people in the whole of Australia wrote letters of complaint at the news stations which filmed that material. We have become very blunted in our response. That's desensitisation. That's a very helpful mechanism in some contexts. If you're a young doctor, you have to get used to dealing with blood and broken bones and bits of bodies in order to cope with the job that needs to be done. And so young doctors in their medical training are desensitised to a number of experiences which otherwise they would not find terribly easy to cope with. I was working this week with fifth year medical students who were getting desensitised to doing pelvic examinations on women. They found it difficult initially to come at, and they have to overcome that reticence or whatever it is and become able to engage in procedures which are not in the normal run of human behaviour. So desensitisation can be adaptive, but it can also be addictive and takes us to seeking out for more and more dramatic, more and more violent stuff if we've got some sort of yen for that. And many of our young people are experiencing the addictive rather than the adaptive component of desensitisation to violence. So it's not healthy if we become blunted to the experience of people being maimed, mutilated, killed before our very eyes, to the point that it no longer seems to matter very much at all. We take violence on the screen almost for granted today, many of us. As we've moved through the powerful visual effects of film and television with the clever technological developments that has made possible for us to see increasingly gruesome fantasy violence and now added on the video screen, we find that we're being exposed to visual experiences of a quite extraordinary intensity, which some years ago would have made a very powerful and emotionally disturbing effect on us. But now it seems to do so less and less. If you find that is so for yourself as an adult, contemplate the effect of the desensitising effect on young children and teenagers who are exposed to such materials from their very earliest days. Some of our teenagers these days like to watch a thing called the Class of 84, which is about a school teacher whose wife becomes pregnant. And the children then get hold of the wife and they saw her up with a chainsaw. They put the chainsaw through the woman and the film rather graphically appears to show this woman being sawn up. Now that's horrendous enough, you might say. But with our clever technology, I'm told that within about a year or so it'll be possible to put that in very convincing colour on the computer screen so that the operator of the computer screen will actually be able to decide how the trawl goes and at what speed and with what intensity, so that the child in effect becomes the person holding the saw. I just think that has to have an effect on people's attitudes and behaviour. An American psychiatrist back in 1974 said, if someone had said a generation ago that a school to teach the art and uses of violence would be established, no one would have believed him. He'd have been told that those whose mandate is the mental welfare of children, that is, parents and professionals, would prevent it. And yet, this education for violence is precisely what's happened and is still happening. We teach violence to young people to such an extent that has never been known before in history. A second major effect, desensitization is one. Its close relative is called disinhibition. Whereas desensitization is concerned with the reaction that we have within ourselves to repeated exposure to such materials, so we become more callous to their effects, disinhibition refers to an increased willingness by people who've seen such materials to act out violently and aggressively against other people. Now, historically, we've long lived with the idea that aggression against other people is wrong. It's all right as long as you don't hurt other people, is the classic humanistic statement still. The taboo against hurting others has been very strong and only legitimised by society under extreme situations like war. Other forms of violence against people have been uniformly condemned and been the subject of legal controls. Indeed, the assumption that one person will not deliberately hurt another is surely the very foundation principle for an ordered and peaceful society. So it should be a matter of considerable concern if we see a change in these inhibitory mechanisms so that people become more willing to act aggressively against others when the opportunity arises. That's disinhibition. It doesn't mean that somebody sees an aggressive film or video and immediately goes off and enacts exactly what they've seen. That's what the critics of this whole business often look for. Can you show us examples of somebody seeing a particular thing and going off and imitating? The answer is yes, we can show you such examples, but they are not the norm. Hoddle Street Massacre, Rambo-type killings and so on are examples of people exactly following that process. But that's the exception. That's straight imitation. But disinhibition is far more subtle. That's a shift of threshold in willingness which accumulates over a number of screenings, a number of viewings, repeated exposures, and then an opportunity and situation which arises, which is somewhat alike, and provides the opportunity to do what otherwise the person would not have done. So the person finds the opportunity for something similar rather than the same. There is a breakdown of the taboo against violence, where a person acts out aggressively in their own particular way according to their context. This has been particularly clearly shown in studies of men's willingness to commit rape after seeing sexually violent films. Lest you think the effect is only on sick people and that rape has nothing to do with ordinary people, let me hasten painfully to disabuse you of that. In a study in California, they gave a number of college students, just ordinary run-of-the-mill college students, opportunity to see some films which included rape scenes. And they compared these students with others who'd not been shown these films, and then they asked people about their willingness to commit rape. And the basic question was, if you had the opportunity to go out and commit rape against a woman and you knew you wouldn't get caught, would you do it? And 51% of these men who'd seen these films said, yes, they would. Now, they weren't sick or kinky, but the idea is sowed with a very small amount of such material. Occasionally, the linkage is more precise, such as the Rambo killings, but they are simply the highlighting unusual events which make it painfully clear how powerful the effect is. So then, there are these two effects. Disinhibition, desensitization. And the disinhibition extends beyond an increased willingness of an individual to go out and do something awful, It extends also to the acceptance that other people might go and do something awful. And you and I are all, to that extent, disinhibited from where we were 50 years ago. We've come to believe that we live in a violent society. We've come to accept the idea that maybe people do get bashed and beaten and raped with terrible frequency. And by virtue of seeing this happening too often, we are part of the pattern of disinhibition, of, as it were, allowing the possibility that other people would do it, even if we wouldn't do it ourselves. So there is that behavioural consequence which is really very disturbing. So we've got insensitivity, we've got disinhibition, and it applies to both violent material, and I'd like to suggest also to a great deal of sexual material. Now that's more controversial, and I make no secret of that. But in the area of sexual violence, there really is very little debate. Sexuality without violence, there is debate. But I was asked a couple of years ago to go and present evidence to this commission here, the Attorney General's Commission in Houston, in Texas. And in order to make my point about this area, I coined the phrase psychological AIDS to say what I thought is happening in relation to sexual and violent material. AIDS is an acronym that we've all learned to live with, and the Grim Reaper has reminded us that there is a disorder out there which is likely to kill some people, and it's likely to have a flow-on effect to a lot of people, and indeed it puts pretty well everybody at risk, more or less, even down to innocent babies maybe getting blood transfusions and dying of AIDS. So we know of it as an extensive and fearsome phenomenon. Psychological AIDS, I coined the term in order to refer to an acquired insensitivity and disinhibition syndrome, meaning that in the psychological arena, we have a situation where we are now seeing a small number of people at so much risk from this material that they go out and kill, that they go out and rape and maim and destroy for the sheer fun of it. And so some die from the disorder. And in a wider context, we are all made at risk. If you do surveys in the Australian population, ask, what is the greatest fear you have? Most women these days will say the fear of being raped. Way up there as among the greatest fears, along with things like the nuclear threat. That's a massive change from 20 years ago. That is less true in Queensland than in the rest of Australia. And my research in this area has caused some ripples because it's been shown that the problem is less in this part of the world, but it's growing here too, and will grow, I suspect, as you change your rules in relation to what's available in the media and in relation to violence and pornographic materials in this state as you proceed through your enlightened times of a new government. You're going to catch up with the rest of us. You're going to progress so that psychological AIDS is likely to catch up with you too. So one of the serious consequences for all of us of increased degrees of violence in the media is that we have, as a society, come to perceive our world as more violent than it used to be, and we have a distorted perception of how violent it really is. There's an increasing gap between the violent world presented on the TV screen and the real-life environment of those who are watching it. We see so many murders and mayhem going on the TV screen that we might come to believe that this is the way life is. And indeed, on television, that is the way life is. But it isn't the way life is in reality yet. There is a great gap. If you ask people roughly how often do you think people get maimed or beaten or killed or whatever, their estimations of the level of violence in our society is far in excess of the actual documented statistics. That's not necessarily comfortable. It's not intended to be reassuring. But it means that our perception of the violent society has shifted. I suspect the real violence may creep up behind us before long and narrow the gap. But at the moment, most people in Australia have a distorted perception of how violent our society really is. Now, we shouldn't be surprised. Some of the best work in this area has come from Brisbane with Professor Peter Sheehan's work on violence on television and studies of young children. And he's found that, something like 5.4 times per hour there is the overt expression of aggression and violence in films and materials that children watch. the frequency of violent episodes indicates the presence of substantial violence on Australian television, he says. I mention that in order to just make reference to the contributions that Professor Sheehan has made to us, not only in this state, but across Australia and wider. He's made some excellent contributions. And in addition to being Professor of Psychology here at St Lucia, he's Chairman of the Commonwealth Films Board of Review and has submitted evidence to the Parliamentary Video Committee recently. He recently summarised his research to the psychological profession in a lecture that he gave at our annual conference up in Townsville. And more recently that lecture was published. And let me quote one more snippet of what he has to say about violent videos and children. Asking professionals about their experience of children being disturbed by exposure to violent videos, he found that 73% thought there was an association between particular children's descriptions of their symptoms and their viewing of violent videos. As many as 91% of these professionals thought the symptoms were possibly precipitated by violent videos. 80% of the professionals felt the videos had a harmful effect, at least some of the time. A multitude of clinical problems was also reported in the survey, and if you've got young children, ask yourself whether you've been bothered by this kind of collection of symptoms: sleeping difficulties, aggressive acting out, nightmares, anxiety, fear, phobic activity, and an instance of borderline psychosis. Isn't that the norm for children? I hope not. But it pops up with incredible frequency in clinics where young people are being assessed. Violent videos are, of course, merely one of the possible things to ask about. Sexual abuse and violent abuse is another consideration, but not unrelated. Similar study from the United Kingdom, 1988, found almost exactly the same symptoms amongst children as I've just read out from here in Queensland. And it was estimated that 6% of adults seeing violent material on television feel violent after watching the shows. That's 2 million adults in the United Kingdom report that they feel as if they're affected in a violent way by watching violent material. So, we have a fair amount of accumulating evidence to suggest that there is a significant effect. It's been followed up in a lot of ways to prove the effect is not just fortuitous, but near as causal as we can get it, particularly by what we call longitudinal studies of following children who are measured at an early age, followed through, known whether they're violent or non-violent when they're young, what they watch as television watchers for a number of years, and then look at them again in adolescence. And there's clear indications that children who were not aggressive before they watched television become aggressive following their heavy doses of television, and particularly violent material. These findings are in striking contrast to the belief that I still hear lurking around the place that exposure to violence in the media can actually have a good effect of making people less violent. What's called the so-called catharsis theory, the old Greek tradition of drama, which told us that if you expressed and worked through your angry feelings, you would feel less angry at the end of it. And if you, in the modern analogy, watch violence on television, you'll displace and deal with that angry feeling that's inside you, and you'll work it out vicariously and won't need to go and be angry and violent at other people. It was a very popular theory. It's been canvassed by the television industry for years on the basis of evidence which is so puny that it doesn't support anything, but they don't mind that. One small study that was methodologically flawed purported to show that catharsis theory. Repeated efforts to replicate the experiment came up with opposite results and showed that people did in fact become more violent, and even the original authors who conducted the study that showed a catharsis theory have come to the conclusion that it's actually the other way around. So if you do hear that theory put around in justification of either violence or sexual materials being good for people, please remember it doesn't have any scientific support. It's simply an argument that pleases the television people who want to put the material on. The evidence in this area is so strong that a remarkable event occurred in 1986, here in Queensland. At the annual conference that I mentioned, of the Australian Psychological Society in Townsville, A series of propositions expressing concern about violence in the media was put to the Conference of Psychologists and was unanimously supported. Never in all my years as a psychologist can I recall a group of psychologists being unanimous about anything before. Indeed, you only have to have one psychologist and find him in two minds to realise that it's virtually an impossibility. Yet here was an issue of great social and scientific significance in which concern was expressed about levels of violence in the media and particularly their effects on children, which led to a unanimous set of proposals being presented to bodies like the Film Censorship Board, the Australian Broadcasting Tribunal, and the Parliamentary Joint Select Committee on Video Materials. Whereas 15 years ago I used to speak on these sort of things to public gatherings and found myself commonly in disagreement with colleagues about the nature of the evidence, and I used to acknowledge there was a great deal of ambiguity in the findings, I now find there's increasing support for saying we must be serious and responsible in addressing these levels of violence. And I now find it very hard to find a psychologist who will disagree with this proposition. And the one on telly last week was one of those oddities they managed to drag out of the woodwork in order to be rather abusive to the person on the programme. So, that in the area of violence, to my mind, is sufficient to say there is a very strong case to answer, and we need to be very much concerned about the many manifestations which are in our society at the present time. It comes up in all sorts of media contexts. Let me finally just spend a few minutes looking at the related theme of sexually explicit materials, or the heading of pornography, if you like. Know more about, but I'll speak less about. In that context, we're not just looking at the effects on children. The primary concern with pornographic materials is that most of it, most often, is in the hands of adults. But despite all the controls that are exercised, a great deal also gets into the hands of children, and so there are effects right across the age range. For at least a decade, the argument has raged about the difference between sexually explicit and violent materials, with some researchers wanting to say, well, violence is negative, but sex materials, that's good for people. Now, the evidence is no better for sexual materials, really, than it is for violent materials. There is not good evidence to show that frequent and intensive exposure to sexually explicit materials has any good effects. The only question is, how bad are the effects? One researcher as long ago as 1970 wrote an article about these two areas, sex and violence, and titled his article, Sex and Violence, You Can't Have It Both Ways. If the effect is shown in relation to violent materials that people become more violent and aggressive, in the area of sexuality, people are going to become more sexually opportunistic and promiscuous, and that is what it's all about. And he says you've got to be logical, and I think that's absolutely right. Both sex and violence are related to drive mechanisms, to arousal mechanisms, and they operate in similar ways. And moreover, they each contribute to the other in important ways, so there is what we call a shared taboo around. That is to say, there are certain things we don't expect to do to one another sexually, and there are things we don't expect to do to one another aggressively. But if we're primed to break the taboo in one area, it's likely to break the taboo in the other area, because both relate to this arousal mechanism which is common to both expressions. So we need to be aware of that kind of interaction that goes on between the two things. If we read the overall findings of that 1986 commission, which has only just begun to be available in this country, I think, it's quite clear that there is potential in both sexually explicit and sexually violent materials to generate important negative consequences. The major trend in the area of pornography of the last 15 years has been to blur the boundaries between sex and violence, so it isn't a case of one or the other, but very commonly both and. There are now substantial numbers of videos circulating in this country which promote the idea that women enjoy being raped, that they derive their attraction for viewers from the ways in which women are humiliated in various kinds of sexually aggressive ways. I was reading just a couple of days ago in one of the recesses of that massive book that there are some 1,500 new videos of a sexually explicit, come sexually violent kind being produced weekly in the United States. Many of which will be coming our way. And if you say to yourself, well, that doesn't matter too much, we've got tight restrictions up in Queensland, don't forget they're available, the worst sort, on mail order out of Canberra without any difficulty to whoever wishes to get hold of them. You're not protected from them under current legislation. In my view, there is incontrovertible evidence that exposure to such materials provides a significant turn-on for a group of people whose sexual appetites are such that they then go out and enact the kind of thing they've seen. They're desensitized to sexual violence, they are disinhibited in their expression of it, and we are all put at risk. It's not surprising to me that the feminists have been up and active and hostile to the emergence of this very anti-woman material. I believe it's got a lot of other objections too, and in the book I wrote a few years ago I made the point that it's anti-God and anti-Christian thinking and anti-family, anti-children as well as anti-woman, and there are a whole lot of reasons why we ought to be concerned about it. I'd love to tell you a whole lot of the ways in which it has negative consequences, but I think I'd rather, perhaps it might be kinder not to, but let me just say this. The evidence continues to pour in to say that we have a major problem in these two areas. There will never be a totally watertight case to show the precise links between what people see and what people do. And let's not wait for that to come in. It won't come. We could theoretically undertake some experiments with people. We could sit children in front of violent and sexually aggressive video materials, say for a couple of weeks solidly, and then observe what they become afterwards, couldn't we? Thankfully, nobody would fund that research. People would be drummed out of town. They'd be locked up for doing it. But I know that your kids and mine get access to video materials and can watch them for hour after hour after hour without any controls and restraints. And some of that material is a horrendous stuff. If they don't see it in your home, they maybe go around the corner and see it in somebody else's. Some of what I've seen and heard about what's happening in people's homes really makes me feel very, very sad indeed. And I don't mean non-Christian homes. I was listening to Dr. James Dobson the other day talking on video about the subject, and he was one of the commissioners who heard all this evidence. And he was making the point that many Christian homes are being devastated by the extent to which men are bringing pornography into the home and looking at pornography, and the children are being influenced by it and so on. So what we would not dare to do experimentally is happening anyway to young children with quite awful consequences. There's increasing evidence now beginning to emerge that not just the violent sexual materials, but just ordinary sexual explicit materials of the kind that's in Playboy and other magazines and presented on films, which doesn't necessarily have violence, can also have significant negative effects. That's being documented, and I think we also need to take seriously. So, as a psychologist, I can't tell you what to do about it. I can tell you where the evidence is and suggest that there is need to do something. As a Christian, I want to say that you need to go more than just being concerned that something ought to be done and challenge you to be aware of evil and do something to stand against it. I hope that you acknowledge the importance of standing against evil. And in the absence of Christian involvement over the last 10 years, the feminist lobby has moved in and done many things that I believe we ought to have done, but backed off from. Many of them know the pain and agony from personal experience and are activated by their own distress. And they act in ways that I can't feel comfortable with. But I am thankful that someone has been doing something at a time when Christians have sat back and hoped it would all go away. It hasn't, and it won't, until we do something. So I hope I might leave that little challenge with you to consider what, if anything, you can do, either personally or collectively. So thank you for listening to me on that subject, and I'd like to field a few questions further on that.
I don't think it's so much that Christians have not done anything. I think those of us who have endeavoured to say some of those things which are being said by, as you say, the feminist group, have always fallen on deaf ears, or as Christians we have been totally disregarded and claimed as being totally out of touch and not knowing what we're talking about.
this has been, I think, my experience, and in many ways it's been the experience of the Presbyterian Church. When letters have been written and so forth, they have not either never been published in the paper, and often they've never even been acknowledged by the politicians to whom they've been written.
I think there are several lines. I agree broadly with what you're saying, but I think there are several things one could say about that. If I said to a feminist, what do? We write letters? Of course, they would say, you're wasting your time. Look, people have been writing letters for donkey's ages. Thousands of letters have poured in petitions galore, and you will be ignored. And they're right. But Christians, being the nice people we are, we go on doing that. Now, I'm a little like my hands tied behind my back, because the feminists will say, let's get a brick and hurl it through that sex shop window. Let's cause a display. Let's cause a sensation. Let's have the media around paying attention. And they will do things that I don't feel it's appropriate to do, unfortunately. But they certainly get results by doing it. They take people round Times Square in New York and in San Francisco, round the sex shops, round the video booths, round the awfulness of it, and say, look at it! That's what we're on about. Now, I wouldn't dare do that to Christians, unfortunately. We would be so repulsed and appalled that we might be sick. And it might be bad for us spiritually to do it. And so I really can't come at that kind of behaviour. But boy, if you want an impact, it's the way to do it. And Dobson, in a film that he's just made, and if you haven't seen it, I encourage you to see it, called Pornography, A Winnable War, describes how, as a commissioner on this thing for the Reagan government, had to go into the sex shops of Houston and New York and so on and see all that was going on in its grottiness. And it has affected him deeply as a person. And he speaks with great pain of some of the things he had to see and do. And I met with him in Houston while we were giving evidence to that commission, and I know some of the things that he saw and did, and I've suffered similarly. And I know that to get into this, it requires more than writing letters, unfortunately. Now, I'm not just sure what the limits are for Christian intervention, but I concede there's a difficulty, but I know that the feminists have been prepared to go a lot further than we have been prepared to go.
The effects of violence on children and so on, I get the feeling that you're talking mainly about adult-type violence. But we find, even with our three-year-old, that just watching cartoons that, with all these robots shooting each other all day, every time he just goes around shooting all day.
Mm. I wish I were just talking about adult violence, but I'm not. I was at a forum last weekend at a church camp where one of our co-speakers was the host to a radio show in town, and a very able media man. Who's been in radio and television for some years. He was Channel 7 reporter for Europe for several years, doing the news, and he says he will not let his children watch the news anymore because he's concerned about the headline news being repeatedly of the kind that it currently is. But by the same token, he also monitors very carefully the question of cartoons, and several of us in the discussion agree that the cartoons do indeed have a negative effect also. We can't laugh it off as just humour. There is a great deal of aggression, and many of the worst are written by people who weren't children's programmers anyway. But they know that aggression generates adrenaline and arousal and interest, and they use this quite calculatedly. So cartoons, too, are bad news. They generate a kind of low-level violence, even when you don't see overt acts of violence. And I personally recall some years ago going to work in California for a while, and not being able to afford a television set. And our kids had been rather used to watching television a fair bit, including the cartoons, and they were from about 12 down, I think, to 4 or 5 or something like that. We have 4 kids. And we took them off and transplanted them in California and said, no television, we haven't got one. And boy, for weeks, that was awful. They were aggressive and irritable and niggly and got at each other. And they really showed an awful lot of unpleasant behaviour. But after, I think, about 5 or 6 weeks, that changed. And they began to find other things to do. And they began to play with each other. And they began to talk. And they began to be inventive. And did a whole lot of things they'd forgotten all about. And it was a real eye-opener to me. And the end of 3 months in California, they had learned they could live without television. But most important, the level of sort of underlying hostility and battling with each other had died away. Quite a short space of time. And so My view today, and this is something I occasionally say to groups, is that if you're a parent with young children and you believe that television is an acceptable thing in your home, don't have it in your home unless you also buy a video recorder. And video the programs that are acceptable for your young children to watch, and then put a complete ban on the television. But give them the green light for the selected bits that you've pre-screened and determined are safe and okay. In other words, if you really want to be responsible about ensuring that they get a good diet, when they're very small, feed them the stuff that you are happy that they can have. Later on, of course, you've got to allow a more responsible decision-making with the children about what they'll watch and why. But in setting the pattern, don't just sit your children in front of the cartoons or anything else without knowing what kind of material is coming up.
Something I'm interested in, I'm watching my burnout though, is Media Watch. And I'm wondering if there's anything in Brisbane that's doing that sort of thing, that people are watching programs and are helping us to know what's good. For example, the cartoons. You know, we have a policy of an hour on the weekend of cartoons, but I don't particularly want to sit and watch the cartoons, and I try to help the children decide whether they're good ones or not.
Yeah.
But I'd like to know if there are people who are also doing that, if there's anything happening in Brisbane at the moment where people cooperate on seeing what's happening in certain programs and whether they're, how suitable they are for children. That's half my question. And the other half is, how protective can we be in the light that they have to mix with their friends and they're going to perhaps see things which aren't going to be acceptable, and if we restrain them too much, then like the idea of no lollies, when they go to somewhere where there's lots of lollies and they will absolutely gorge themselves. This is a question I have about how restrained we need to be. And therefore, if they go somewhere where there is a TV freely available, that they will perhaps sit there glued and take everything in.
That second point would be my concern about people who say, well, we won't have television in our home. I'm inclined to say that's not the way to handle it, because of that problem of them then having access sooner or later in all sorts of other ways, and it becomes a lot more attractive looking. I think you need to be responsibly training them in those earlier years before there's much contact outside the home, and to get some discrimination working. And the video provides that time shift phenomenon, so that if there is a good program on and the kids are at school, you grab it for them and they see it when it's time appropriate for them. And if you can do that cooperatively and collectively, that's great. And the question is there any sort of cooperation going on around the place to enable parents to do that? Does anybody know of anything to help there? No help? No. It would be worth doing, for sure.
Right. At the moment, I'm midway through a saga with my local Member of Parliament, a federal parliament who is a member of the government, on a clear-cut issue of blasphemy on ABC TV. And because of the bureaucracy, and because the ABC aren't really interested in dealing with the issue, things have got bogged down. Now, if I'm having trouble with something which is covered in the Broadcasting Act and defined as blasphemy, how much more trouble can I expect to have in dealing with something like violence or explicit sexuality? And I know I'm dealing with the ABC, not the commercial channels, in working through the official channels of the Parliament.
Okay, two things. One, I would have thought that in relation to the ABC, I think you recognise a distinction, but let's make it to others, that the regulations governing the ABC are different from those governing the commercial stations.
They are covered by the blasphemy ones.
Right. Yeah. But in general, if you've got problems with the commercial stations, it's easier to take action through the organisation that's set up to monitor that, from which the ABC generally stands clear. Now, the blasphemy issue, as you say, covers across the board, but I think you'll have less success in general with blasphemy than the matter of violence, because the current of present opinion, social and scientific, is against violence and recognising increasingly that that's not on. And indeed, Maggie Thatcher's Parliament just the other week saying that they will actually sue television stations that show violent programmes is the current response to the sort of massacre situations they've had in Britain. So if you go to your Member of Parliament and plug the violence issue, he won't dare to ignore you. But he knows on the blasphemy issue, he can ignore you and find a good deal of support amongst his peer group, because there will not be a lot of people willing to push that issue. So I think you've taken a hard one. I'm not saying you shouldn't take it, but it's a much easier issue to to tackle is the one of violence. Sexuality is harder because a lot of people still want sex in, even though they are unhappy about the violence effects.
In support of my local member, I must say that I don't think it's a lack of support of the local member. I think it's more from the bureaucracy's point of view.
Oh, I would think that's right. Yes, I think it'll get lost in the machinery if you push that one, frankly. Yeah. Yes, unhappily. Just a couple more. I think we're almost out of time.
I'd like to raise one which is probably a rather large red herring. But I'm just interested in your comments on the fact that exposure to specific information and specific film on sex is influencing kids. One of the things I've been wondering about in my job is been just how much our sex education programs are in fact saying to kids, look, this is how you do it, this is really what it's all about, and the exposure just to that is enough to change their behaviour and change their attitudes and make them more promiscuous and comfortable with and lower their inhibitions. Do you see any connection there at all? Let's just raise some questions for Mr. Weatherly.
It's an important question. I suspect it's going to be addressed vigorously tomorrow amongst the school teachers, I hope anyway, because it would seem to me one of the real concerns about confronting sex education, that there's an area of information that young people need, but the danger is that in providing that information, you encourage them or reduce the barriers against exploration and experimentation. And I think the evidence from the drug studies, first of all, was that's what tended to happen in the drug education programs and in the sex education programs, and in both cases where they were presented in a supposedly value-free orientation. I don't think they've ever been presented in a value-free way, but they have been presented without a clear set of moral guidelines, and that's not value-free. And when you present it simply as information without any moral implications, of course kids want to go and experiment. And of course the rate of sexual activity amongst young people rises. I think that's entirely predictable, and that's certainly what has happened in many cases. So if it is to be taught, the question is who teaches it, in what context, and then in what moral framework. Some would say it shouldn't be in the school at all, and that's something I hope we'll talk a bit about tomorrow. But it would seem to me that if it is taught within the school context, it needs to be taught with clear moral guidelines, unashamedly. Because otherwise the message is, it's okay, let's go. And that really is the message they're getting already from all around, quite apart from the school endorsing it. They don't need too much more encouragement, do they? So I think it's a good and it's a difficult one to confront, because again the alternative is not to say, well, we won't talk about sex at all, we'll give them no education at all. If we say that, it doesn't mean they're getting no sex education, it just means they're getting a different sort, which is even worse. One more?
Not specifically a question. I'd simply like to mention that I've been in Queensland for about 12 months, having come from New South Wales. I was involved with some organisations in New South Wales in this general area, and my general feeling is that things aren't as bad in Queensland, as you've acknowledged. I'm wondering whether there is locally a representation of people like the Festival of Light, who will freely make available material that is quite current in a lot of the areas and provides avenues of by which people can voice their concern. We find down south that very often within the churches the attitude is that it's happening, we can't do anything about it, the tidal wave is too big. It seems to tie in with something of our Australian characteristic, which wants us to stand back and watch the passing parade go by and not get involved. There does appear to be this great challenge going to the church at the present time that we have to get involved, that in actual fact we are denying our faith by not getting involved, and the area of involvement obviously are open to us through the parliamentary channels and other courses that we have, but perhaps the greatest area of involvement is in our neighbourly talking to our associates, the people that we mix with, where we deliberately get involved in P&Cs. After our youngest child left school, we continued on in the local PNC Association of Port Macquarie. We went through a very torrid time, and some of the events that were aroused were published nationally over the news media. But we found that rather than having nothing to say, people were listening to what we were saying as citizens, but not parents. There was not any longer the threat that our child might suffer at the hands of some teachers because we would dare to challenge what some teachers were saying. Our children were no longer in that situation. And I believe that that's an area that we can utilise very effectively, that we shouldn't just drop our association with the school simply because we no longer have children there, if it is an opportunity through a Parents and Citizens Association. And I'm just wondering what is available in Queensland in terms of making contact with organisations so that the people in the churches have the information on hand to act upon it.
Okay, that's perhaps something to address to the local folks. I'm aware that the Festival of Light is national. I'm aware that the Festival of Light takes a fair amount of flack through the media, and anybody who's never met Fred Nile believes he's a complete idiot, and the media have ensured that he's set up that way. I'm also fascinated by the fact that the people who know him have re-elected him yet again to the upper house in New South Wales, so he can't be a complete idiot to the people whom he actually speaks with. But if you see what the media can do to someone whom they really don't like, he's a fairly prized example, and I think you've had similar examples here in Brisbane. People have taken the issue seriously, have been made to look as if they were completely stupid. There have been organisations, I believe there still are, existing in Queensland, but let me just add that in the expo setting, there will be a major 3 or 4 day conference mounted by the newly established Australian Federation for Decency, which will be focusing on these issues as a deliberate Christian witness in the expo setting. And I think about a dozen people are being called from around the world to present papers within a Christian perspective. So it will all be happening here, hopefully in the middle of August. And you might care to get behind that exercise. But somebody else may want to say about what the organisations are currently. Festival of Light used to be around, and Mrs. Joyner's stop was around. I don't know if that's still around.
Right.
Yeah. It's a very difficult area to set up an organisation, I may say. Anybody who does it half well is going to get blasted out of town, and if anybody has the least little chink in their armour or least oddity, they're going to be absolutely hounded out of sight. So it's the sort of thing you have to get into perhaps for a year or two vigorously and then pass on the mantle to somebody else if you're to survive. I think that's the best strategy for most people. Well, I would have thought that perhaps ought to bring us to a close, as the tape is going to run out any moment. And I hope that's been enough to stimulate your thinking and hopefully your action. Thank you for attending this evening. I do appreciate you turning out on this Easter Monday.